Happy Monday and good evening. And we begin the readout tonight with what should sound like a familiar story. 12 years ago, in 2010, the pro-Western, pro-reform government of Ukraine was narrowly defeated at the ballot box, ousted by a Kremlin-backed gangster who vowed to never allow his country to join the ranks of NATO. That man was Viktor Yanukovych, a low-key criminal and failed politician who was pushed to power by wealthy oligarchs, Vladimir Putin, and an American political consultant who we've come to know all too well, Paul Manafort. Now, it didn't matter that Yanukovych's party was a haven for mobsters. The key was to replace the pro-Western government in Kyiv with a pro-Kremlin puppet. And Manafort was happy to oblige for a tidy fee. Needless to say, the government under Yanukovych entered a downward spiral of thuggery, corruption, and crackdowns. And Yanukovych's political opponent, Yulia Tymoshenko, well, she was literally locked up after her defeat. It's normal practice, Yanukovych told Time magazine in reference to his jailing of the opposition leader. The party is powerful. The voters support it. When Western countries objected to her arrest, Manafort hired lobbyists in Washington to spin her imprisonment as an example of Ukraine's commitment to the rule of law. As Tymoshenko's daughter explained, their job is to say that white is black and black is white. Now, Manafort's apprentice, Donald Trump, whom he also helped to elect in 2016 with Russia's backing, is acting a lot like that Ukrainian strongman. And he's embarked from his MAGA cocoon. He's emerged from his MAGA cocoon as a fully formed authoritarian butterfly. Trump is not only endorsing the thuggery of January 6th, he is now promising to reward the insurrectionists for the violence they committed in his name. Speaking at a rally in Texas this weekend, Trump said that if he retakes the White House in 2024, he may offer them presidential pardons.
Another thing we'll do, and so many people have been asking me about it, if I run and if I win, we will treat those people from January 6th fairly. We will treat them fairly. And if it requires pardons, we will give them pardons.
Behind the scenes, Trump is also planning a massive cover-up of his role in inciting the violence that day, seeking to bolster the baseless conspiracy theory that the FBI did it. According to the Daily Beast, Trump has privately told GOP lawmakers, congressional candidates, and operatives in recent months that Republicans on Capitol Hill should be prepared to launch a full-blown investigation to get to the bottom of how FBI agents supposedly caused violence and mayhem on January 6th. At the same time, Trump is mobilizing his MAGA cult against the law enforcement entities that could stand in the way of another run for president. Here's how he lashed out at New York's Attorney General, Manhattan's District Attorney, and the DA of Fulton County, Georgia, all of whom were investigating him and all of whom happened to be black.
Well, these prosecutors are vicious, horrible people. They're racist and they're very sick. They're mentally sick. They're going after me without any protection of my rights by the Supreme Court or most other courts. In reality, they're not after me. They're after you.
Most ominously, Trump summoned his supporters, much like he did before January 6th, to take to the streets in a massive show of force if he's prosecuted.
If these radical, vicious, racist prosecutors do anything wrong or illegal, I hope we are going to have in this country the biggest protest we have ever had in Washington, D.C., in New York, in Atlanta, and elsewhere, because our country and our elections are corrupt.
Separately, Trump also signaled last night that he is no longer even willing to pay lip service to Democratic elections. He's now attacking the Republican lawmakers who are seeking to reform the Electoral Count Act of 1887, so there's zero ambiguity about the vice president's power, or lack thereof, when it comes to certifying the votes of the Electoral College. But that's not what Donald Trump wants his followers to believe. He is claiming that efforts to reform the law, which, by the way, are no substitute for federal reforms that reverse these Republican state attacks on the right to vote, that those laws are, that this change to the law is just validation, that Mike Pence did have the right to change the outcome, and that lawmakers are now trying to take that right away. And he whined that Pence could have overturned the election. It actually marks the first time that Trump has dropped his cover story of massive voter fraud and explicitly stated that his goal was indeed to overturn the election that he lost. Joining me now is Jason Johnson, professor of journalism and politics at Morgan State University and host of the Slate podcast, A Word with Jason Johnson. And Masha Gessen, writer for The New Yorker and author of Surviving Autocracy. And Masha, I want to start with you first. I know that you've spent some time in Ukraine. And, you know, I would love for you to sort of tease out for us these ways in which Donald Trump is really sort of emerging. I sort of described as emerging from a cocoon as a full authoritarian. I mean, he's hitting all the marks now, threatening, you know, to go after the FBI, investigate them for supposedly being the real attackers on January 6th and all the rest. Your thoughts?
Right. Well, the project that Donald Trump is following right now, we actually know this not so much from Ukraine or Russia, actually, but from a couple of other Eastern Central European countries where we saw an autocratic attempt. And then during the period when the autocrat was out of office, this building of legitimacy by the future autocrat, right, and by attacking the legitimacy of the actually legitimate government, right? It's a very familiar narrative where basically, you know, what we're hearing Donald Trump say is not that the Biden administration is doing something wrong, right? There's no engagement on the issues. It's that it shouldn't exist at all. That the only legitimate administration in this country is the Trump administration, right? Which is why we keep continuing, or he keeps continuing to return to the supposedly fraudulent election, right? And to January 6th, which you would think, right, logically may not be the most beneficial thing for him to return to if he were attacking the administration on the merits, but he's attacking the administration as illegitimate.
And let me play for you, Liz Cheney, you know, and Jason Johnson. I'm going to throw this to you because, you know, the people who don't want him to do this are the norm core Republicans and the, you know, norm core conservative Republicans like Liz Cheney, who would like to see the Republican Party return to something that can go back to, you know, so the Reaganite tax cutting, you know, damn the poor, that kind of thing. She's fine with that. Right. It's just this kind of thing. She's not for it. Here she is talking about what Trump said this weekend.
Well, I think certainly the two things, the suggesting that he would provide pardons for the January 6th defendants. And again, we know that a number of those people have been charged with seditious conspiracy. And also the acknowledgement that he was in fact attempting to overturn the election. Those two things really demonstrate what his intention was. They demonstrate what he would do if he were given the chance again.
Your thoughts, Jason?
This is why this doesn't make any sense to me and why there aren't constant alarm bells in the administration. When we have to go to people like Liz Cheney as examples of reasonable people, right? Liz Cheney, who's perfectly happy suppressing votes, who's perfectly happy engaging in lots of other behaviors and policies that I find to be ultimately damning and difficult for democracy. It shows what a dire circumstance we're in. Of course, we know what Donald Trump is trying to do. Of course, we know what he was attempting to do. Why do we think that the insurrection has had a plan that was eerily similar to the PowerPoint that the Trump administration was handing around like high school notes when they were preparing to try to take over the government on January 6th? Like, all of these things are known now. So the question isn't, are we moving towards autocracy? The question isn't, oh my gosh, is he becoming more obvious? The question is, who is going to do something about it? I have seen less obvious plans on episodes of Scooby-Doo. Like, it's really clear what they're planning to do in 2024. So the question is, what can the president do? What will the president do? What will Merrick Garland do? Because they're going to keep talking about their plans and dropping little breadcrumbs about what they're doing. But if we don't do anything about it, we will only have ourselves to blame if this democracy falls.
Well, their breadcrumbs are actually full sandwiches at this point. Here's Newt Gingrich, you know, saying the quiet part, like screaming the quiet part. Here he is.
And I think when you have a Republican Congress, this is all going to come crashing down, and the wolves are going to find out that they're now sheep, and they're the ones who are, in fact, going to, I think, face a real risk of jail for the kind of laws they're breaking.
I'm going to follow that with a Republican candidate for the Michigan State Senate who told a crowd that people should show up with guns to protect Republican election observers. Here is that candidate.
Are you armed? I can't be serious. The Second Amendment isn't there for hunting rights. It's not there for self-defense. The Second Amendment is there. The founders put it there to protect all the others. So if you ask, what can we do? Show up armed.
So in addition to a candidate for Michigan State Senate saying a crowd should show up armed to monitor the counting of ballots or to protect election observers who are so-called monitoring the counting of ballots, Yahoo News did a poll and asked, would Republicans vote for a candidate who admits that Joe Biden won the 2020 election? Only 57% said they would not vote for a candidate who would admit that Joe Biden is the legitimate president. So, Masha, I think Jason asked a good question. In the case where we are sort of mired in a very obvious authoritarian, you know, sort of freak show, what ought the administration, the Justice Department, what can they do about it at this point?
That's a great question. I think that there have to be efforts to restore the legitimacy of this administration, right? And it has to be an all-encompassing project. It has to be a project that includes creating a kind of national narrative, which includes both what happened on January 6th, you know, which I don't think the administration has done a great job about. It's really, stepped away from telling that story, right? Trying to find some kind of middle ground between prosecuting the insurrectionists and letting sort of the process take care of itself, and in this very American way, just moving on and letting bygones be bygones, which is the absolute worst thing you can do because there's nothing bygone about this, right? I mean, what we're watching is a huge part of the country that really sincerely believes that the election was stolen. And, you know, if you consider that for a second, you realize that showing up with guns to election counting is not an unreasonable thing to do in that framework. Right. Imagine you really believe that your democracy was stolen from you. What are you going to do about it is a question that they're asking themselves in exactly the same way that we're asking ourselves. Right. It has to be a huge national effort. And that's the one thing that we're not observing.
We're seeing, Jason, that it does appear that in some ways the administration is counting on the January 6th committee to tell that narrative. We know former Chief of Staff Mark Short is now testified in front of the committee. People are testifying. Is it good enough for the January 6th committee to eventually put that narrative forward if the administration isn't doing it?
I haven't seen a committee fundamentally change anything in American politics over the last 10 years outside of what happened the gentleman who just got on the Supreme Court. For some reason, his name has escaped me right now. At the end of the day, the committee is not going to be enough. It's not. If you don't start seeing people suffer consequences, if you don't start seeing people go to jail, then the committee is not going to be enough. If Merrick Garland isn't sending people on perp walks, then the committee is not going to be enough. And this is the thing. And I want everybody to understand this, because sometimes I'm called cynical or being unfair or putting the blame on the wrong people. We're at a point now where the House is burning. Okay, the House, democracy, it is burning. Now, we can argue about who set it on fire. We know the Republicans set it on fire. But at this point, this administration is sitting there with a fire hose going back and forth on who's going to turn it on. It doesn't matter how the house started burning. We got to stop the fire at this point. And so, you know, to me, I don't think that a committee is going to be enough. I don't think this is beyond narratives at this point, Joy. This is the fact that we've got in Arizona, we've talked about several states, Arizona right now passed new laws that basically are going to allow the Republican legislature to discount any votes that they don't like. We're beyond the point of just having no drop boxes. We're literally getting to the point where legislatures are going to say, if we don't like the results, your votes don't matter.
Yeah. And Masha, last question. You just come back from Ukraine. How seriously do you think we are at risk of what happened to Ukraine morphing into war with Russia, or a war between Ukraine and Russia, or something even bigger with NATO involved?
Right. Well, we're not going to know until we know. The president of Ukraine is very much trying to sort of spread calm to say there's nothing that we're seeing now that we haven't been seeing for the last 8 years. And he has a very strong point, right? He's trying to remind the world that Ukraine has, in fact, been at war with Russia, or rather, Russia has been at war with Ukraine for the last 8 years. The threat to Ukraine is ongoing. What's important about this also is that Vladimir Putin sees himself as being at war with the United States. Ukraine is irrelevant to his view of what's happening and the game that he's playing. That's the incredibly tragic thing about being in Ukraine, because the fate of Ukraine, this country of 44 million people who fought so hard for their democracy, is being decided by the big players. And there's no, you know, the Ukrainians keep saying no Ukraine, no discussing Ukraine without Ukraine, but that's exactly what's happening.
It's happening.
And Ukraine is not going to have a role in deciding whether there's a war.
It's a tragic situation, but it's also a cautionary tale. And I think that's why we stay on this story, because we need to understand we could be Ukraine. Any country can go in that direction. No country is that special or unique. Masha Gessen, always great to talk with you. Jason Johnson, my friend, thank you very much. Always appreciate you both. And it is a very special night, by the way, on The Readout. We are launching an important new segment that we call Democracy Defenders. Very apropos. And the amazing Stacey Abrams is appropriately our very first Democracy Defender. We're going to talk about the latest Republican attacks on voting rights and democracy and her current campaign for governor of Georgia. Plus, changes are coming to Spotify after music legends say they have had enough of Joe Rogan's COVID misinformation. And tonight's absolute worst, who would have ever thought that implementing absurd, expensive MAGA policies would blow up in their faces? Surprise! The Readout continues after this. Okay, let's face it. The Trump years have been exhausting. Day after day, he and his Republican followers pull at the strings of our democracy, just picking it apart like you would an old sweater, by waging daily assaults against women's rights, immigrants, Muslims, African Americans, the LGBTQ community. The list just goes on and on and on. The 2020 election was the moment when 81 million Americans said enough and got rid of Trump. The Goblin King was finally gone, and his brand of toxic politics was repudiated. And then January 6th happened, and we all watched in horror as thousands of insurrectionists stormed the Capitol, assaulted police officers, defecated in the buildings built by enslaved hands, and openly hunted members of Congress and the vice president, looking to hang them with a noose, like a proper lynching. Sadly, that was just the beginning, not the end. Little did we know what would come next. How can we anticipate the death threats against the people who certified the elections, the vindictive voting laws targeting marginalized communities who helped elect President Biden and Vice President Harris, and now the open embrace of Stalin-esque censorship by banning books? It's like we got to the top of the hill pushing a boulder only for it to come crashing back down. Look, it is easy to get crushed under the weight of all of this. It makes you want to just look away, tune out, and turn off. But you can't. Not now. Not with so much at stake. Just a few weeks ago, I told you that America's exceptionalism has always been sown by the millions of regular Americans who have summoned the courage in the face of fierce adversity to rewrite destiny. Well, tonight, I am proud to debut a new segment that we are going to bring to you on a regular basis. And it is called Democracy Defenders. It's going to be an opportunity to hear from the folks who are working to make this country a little more just and equitable. Like Taylor Coleman, who decided to uproot her life and dedicate the next year to traveling throughout Texas in a van, learning the intricacies of the state's new draconian voting laws and registering people to vote. She's just one example of regular folks fighting for big things. It's the election workers counting your votes. It's the activists registering millions of Americans so that they can vote. It's the neighborhood lady making sure that you have a ride. These heroes are real-life Americans, but even better. There are real-life Avengers, but even better. And you know why? Because they are real. And tonight, we launch Democracy Defenders. And we want to introduce you to our inaugural guest, someone who did the work of voter registration, faced a crushing loss, dusted herself off, and recommitted to democracy. This person helped to register 95% of eligible voters in her state. And I am now joined by Stacey Abrams, Democratic candidate for governor in Georgia, founder of Fair Fight and inaugural member of the Readout Democracy Defenders. And Stacey, it is always great to talk with you. Thank you so much for being here on our first rollout of this segment. And I just want to let you sort of set the stage here because, you know, I met you back in 2014. We were both guests on the Melissa Harris Perry show, and I met you in the green room, I think was the first time I met you. And you were talking about this plan you had, and you were like, we have 700,000 unregistered voters in the state of Georgia. We're going to go and register them. And you literally have gone out like, damn, you're done that, and registered like that huge group of voters. Talk a little bit about the backlash you got almost immediately from the then Secretary of State, now governor, and how you are fighting back against that.
Well, first of all, Joy, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for initiating this celebration of the people who are necessary to stave off not only autocracy, but the collapse of an ideal that has sustained countries around the world, and that is American democracy. In 2014, when we met, I'd launched an organization that was designed to register people of color who were the least likely to be registered in the state of Georgia. And through the efforts of the New Georgia Project and countless other organizations, over the last near decade, we've managed to register or encouraged to register 95% of the people of Georgia. Now, let's be clear, there are mechanisms in place that make that possible. But the conversation about voting, the loud conversation about the intentionality of voter suppression started in 2014. And sadly, it was suborned by this voter suppression was suborned by the person who is now the governor of Georgia. And my decision to run for governor, both in 2018 and again today, is because of something you said. It's about regular people. I am proud to be someone who is fighting for voting rights because I've been a small business owner. I've been a tax attorney. I'm an aunt to six young kids who need good education and need hope and opportunity, who live in the state of Georgia. And I want them to grow up in a state and in a nation that values who they are. And that can only happen if we have leaders who see them and believe in them, and if we have a democracy that allows their families to have a say in their future.
And, you know, you started this project the year after the Shelby decision, in which essentially the idea of repressing the vote was just sort of opened and thrown open by the Roberts Court. And, of course, all of these states rushed in and started doing it. You saw in your state, the then Secretary of State, now Governor Kemp, started pulling people off the rolls almost as fast as you could help get them on. And now he and Brad Raffensperger, who actually stood up to Trump previously in 2020, they're now peddling back even further. We've seen counties in Georgia go from seven places to vote to one. We've seen people who were in charge of elections thrown out if they are seen to be more leaning toward Democrats. Like, it's pretty aggressive. You're now running against, this is a rematch between you and Brian Kemp. The atmosphere now is even worse than it was before in 2018. And you look at the polling, whereas the two of you were neck and neck. You know, you came very, very close to defeating him the first time. A lot of people would argue that if he hadn't taken all those people off the rolls, you would have taken it in a walk. Now, the polling shows that a lot of Republicans have fed into the big lie. They believe in the big lie. And the polling shows you behind Kemp and behind Perdue. What do you do about that?
Well, let's begin with understanding that polling is a snapshot. And it is not the Oracle at Delphi. It's not a predictor of what will be. It's a snapshot of where we are. And where we are right now is that not a single person, including the incumbent governor, has 50% of the people of Georgia behind them. And I have not yet launched a full campaign. And in fact, we're excited because today is the last day of fundraising for this quarter deadline. And we want to post the best numbers possible. So invite people to go to StacyAbrams.com to support our campaign. But here's why. We know that the big lie has activated and energized so many people. But we also know that the reality of voter suppression and the reality of inaction has led to a deflation. But deflation can be reversed. We can energize and engage, but we've got to do the work. And this is January 31st. We've got until November 8th. And that is a long time to have conversations, a long time to let people know how we do what we did in 2018, which is understand the challenges and navigate them, understand the obstacles and make a way over them. Because that's what we've always done. That's what democracy, unfortunately, has demanded of Americans for too long, that we have to fight for it. And if we're willing to do the work to have access, we will get the results we need. I am proud of the work that we're doing, and I see that poll or those polls and their polls that have us closer and some that have us further apart, but they're all the same thing. They're a story of where we are and not a prediction of where we will be. Because I know that when we started this in 2017, I was even further behind and we came so close, and we know that we can get over the finish line and bring Georgians with us, because I believe that we can serve all of Georgia, one Georgia, working together to make sure everyone has access and opportunity.
Let's talk about the atmosphere in which you are running for the governor of Georgia. I mean, you had Fani Willis, who is investigating Donald Trump for interfering in the previous election, having to increase security because of the threats that were made over the weekend by the former president, and the threats really, you know, coming from his base, a lot of which is armed, a lot of which is violently opposed to anything like Democrats ever beating Republicans. So you've got that atmosphere. And then, of course, you have the law itself, which is going to be difficult for voters to overcome. How do you deal with that in a state like Georgia, where you've got both the sort of threats of violence that are out there and also just the hoops that voters are going to have to jump through in order to vote?
We have three things going for us. One is that we've seen a dramatic increase, as you pointed out earlier, in the number of people who are registered. The sheer volume of opportunity among voters is an incredible thing, because voter suppression does work. But one of the ways we were able to combat it in 2018, defeat it in 2020 and 2021, was the sheer volume of people who pushed against those barriers. And so it's making sure that all of these new voters, nearly 1.3 million new registered voters since 2018, that we turn those voters out, because they are modeled by 17 points to be more likely to be Democratic leaning voters. And I want to do my part to turn them out. Number two, we're going to raise the resources to invest in those voters and make sure they know what the rules are, how they've changed, and how to vote. And then three, we're going to tell a story about what is to come. Yes, we are in pain. This is a nation and a state that has been hurt by a pandemic and by injustice, but we also have opportunity, and we have to talk about what can be if we do the work together. Those three things are how we make a difference, and that's why I'm running for governor.
And the Georgia is going to be pretty blockbuster. It's yourself, Raphael Warnock, running for re-election. Even the kooky lady, what's her name? The QAnon lady's up too. There's going to be a lot going on in the state of Georgia. But don't go anywhere. Stacey Abrams is going to stick around, because up next, if Trouble Stiltskin has his way, this guy here at here will be in charge of certifying the next presidential election in Georgia.
It's a federal takeover of our elections. It will install the ability for Democrats, quite frankly, to cheat.
He is just one of 20 Trump-backed election deniers vying for Secretary of State offices around the country. This is really important stuff. Stay right there. We are back with Stacey Abrams, candidate for governor of Georgia and our inaugural Readout Democracy Defender. You know, Stacey, I want to zoom out just a little bit, because there's a lot that's going on sort of nationwide. And I know you have a national organization that's all about sort of preserving our democracy. This first one is this idea of people running to oversee elections. You dealt with one of these already as Secretary of State in Georgia when Kemp had that job. That's now been like exploded across the country. What will it mean to have people, if they win, there's 21 of these, and they win office and they don't believe that Joe Biden is the president? Talk about the role of Secretary of State and what kind of shenanigans they could literally pull off, and how do we defend against it?
We have in the state of Georgia a prime example of why a Secretary of State matters in multiple ways. And we know that among the contenders, we have someone who has vowed to essentially do the bidding of one person instead of the bidding of the people. And when you multiply that across the country, what you have is the undermining of elections. And that's what we chastise Russia for. That's what we chastise autocracies for. It is when you take the right of the people to be heard away from them. And it's not when you do it at the point of a gun. It's when you do it with the pen. It's when administrators use their imprimatur to steal the voices of the people. And that should never be tolerated, regardless of party. And I think what's so important in Georgia is that we have an incredibly strong slate of folks running down ballot. And we, and Joy, you know this, people tend to vote at the top of the ticket and go home. It is so important that we go all the way down the ballot, that we not only pick a great Secretary of State, but that we pick really strong attorneys general. The AG is the person who decides who gets sued. Here in the state of Georgia, every time President Biden has done something good for the people, unfortunately, while he's not spending the money, the governor has sued the president. We need strong attorneys general willing to say, we are going to defend the people that we serve. And we need incredible senators like Raphael Warnock, because we need people in the federal level who understand what's at stake. This is not an individual issue. This is a national crisis. And I heard your earlier panel talk about this. We need secretaries of state. We need attorneys general. We need governors. We need U.S. senators. We need all of the defenders of democracy to stand for office and to win. And to do that, We've got to invest in their campaigns. We've got to knock on their doors. And we've got to do everything in our power to ensure that the best people make it across the finish line, because that is how we stave off the onslaught that we know is coming from the other side.
We also need some federal legislation, which would be nice. And there's been a failure on the part of Democrats to use their very slim majority, their 50-50 Senate and with plus one with the vice president, to pass federal voting protections. The substitute that people like Manchin and Sinema have now joined onto with some Republicans who really don't give, you know, they don't give a damn about passing voting rights legislation. They're now trying to use this Electoral Count Act reform as a substitute. Every person I know that's involved in voting rights and civil rights says it is not a substitute. But if you could just explain, you know, Electoral Count Act is nice, but is, in your view, that enough to protect our elections?
It is insufficient to solve the challenges, the twin challenges of voter suppression and election subversion. It solves one piece of the puzzle, but you're basically saying that the house is going, we're going to have a flood that wipes out all the houses, but we'll save the very last one. Well, the problem is the flood's already gone through. And so we have to stave off every other moment of crisis. That's why the voting rights legislation that failed earlier is so important. And let's remember, it didn't get a vote, and that means it's still alive and we can still push for it. Sadly, I think it's going to be stories like what's come out of Texas about the 95-year-old World War II veteran being denied the right to vote in Texas because he can't provide a number that he used 45 years ago. That's what's going to happen. It's the story that was in Mother Jones about the number of people in Georgia who've already been denied the right to vote. It's going to take these stories of proof in action of what is happening at the state level, the onslaught of insurrectionists now taking up arms in our state houses as legislators who are passing these raft of laws to undermine our democracy. We cannot afford inaction. And while the ECA may be a solution to a smaller problem, it is not the solution to the massive crisis that is facing our democracy. That's why I'm running. That's why Raphael Warnock is running. That is why we need the support of every good American. Regardless of your politics, our patriotism should say that we need democracy defenders at every level of government, and we need them now.
Democracy defender Stacey Abrams, who is running for governor in the state of Georgia. This is a race to watch. We will definitely be having you back on, and we will be paying a lot of attention to what happens in Georgia this year. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you, Stacey Abrams. Cheers. Thank you. All right. And still ahead, Joe Rogan responds to critics who accuse him of spreading dangerous vaccine misinformation on Spotify as another musical artist removes her music in protest. That is next. We'll be right back. The Joe Rogan Experience is now a Joe Rogan PR disaster for Spotify, Rogan's sole distributor. The podcast, which generates millions of viewers per episode, regularly features prominent vaccine skeptics who tout misinformation. That includes conspiracy theorist and Sandy Hook truther Alex Jones. It took high-profile talent boycotts for Spotify to address the problem. Music legends Neil Young and Joni Mitchell have taken a stand by removing their music from the platform. And Nils Lofgren of Bruce Springsteen's E Street Band also said he would cut ties and urged others to do the same. The moves made headlines, but didn't change anything until in terms of Spotify taking a stand. Instead, CEO Daniel Ek wrote a public letter saying the streaming service would try really, really, really hard not to spread toxic garbage lies, promising content advisory warnings to Rogan's show, which we all know do nothing. Rogan also made a statement on Instagram addressing the controversy, sort of.
I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm just a person who sits down and talks to people and has conversations with them. Do I get things wrong? Absolutely, I get things wrong. But I try to correct them. Whenever I get something wrong, I try to correct it because I'm interested in telling the truth. I'm interested in finding out what the truth is. If there's anything that I've done that I could do better is have more experts with differing opinions right after I have the controversial ones. I would most certainly be open to doing that.
Joining me now is NBC News senior reporter Ben Collins and Teray, creative director for The Griot. Teray, my friend, it is always great to see you. I'm going to start with you. Let me play a
nice
little bit.
For you.
Those of you, for the few people who are not familiar with Joe Rogan, for those who are not, let me just play a little bit, a little mashup of Rogan's podcast.
If you're like 21 years old and you say to me, should I get vaccinated? I go, no.
You have one step away from a king. You have one step closer. You're moving one step closer to dictatorship. That's what the is happening. That's what's going to happen with a vaccine passport. This is really gene therapy. It's a different thing. It's your body. It's tricking your body. The black and white thing is so strange because like the shades are
tan
so
tan and brown.
There's such a spectrum of shades of people. Unless you're talking to someone who is like 100% African from the darkest place where they're not wearing any clothes all day and they've developed all that melanin to protect themselves from the sun. You know, it, even the term black is weird.
Okay, so I'm going to stipulate that my father is African. I'm black. Teray, you're African-American. You're black. Just for those of you who might be confused by his non-expertise. So he does this thing of like, I'm not an expert. I'm just asking questions. But there he is definitively saying things. If you're 21 years old, you shouldn't get vaccinated. It's gene therapy. Like he is putting him. People believe him like he's an expert. Your thoughts?
I mean, Joe Rogan is a really dumb person who thinks that he's smart. So he has these sort of pseudo-scientific conversations that absolutely erode the brain. In terms of COVID, here's what he's doing. We are in a crowded theater where there's a fire, and he's saying, no, guys, there's no fire. Everything's fine. It is not appropriate for the country to have somebody with this level of platform who's telling people, you don't need to get vaccinated. You don't need to do these sort of things. He used to get tested all the time, and he would talk about how he had this stockpile of tests, so anybody who entered his little bunker or whatever would have to get tested. But I don't know what happened to that. He's become this person who like doesn't seem to believe in it. The whole Jordan Peterson conversation about what really is black and is white, it's just sort of indicative of the stupidity of his conversations. Does it really enhance anyone's knowledge to point out that this is not actually the color black? No, it is, does not. Right? Like Ben is actually not the color white. That doesn't enhance anybody's understanding of this actual situation. But, you know, if you go down the 3-hour rabbit hole of Joe Rogan, you get somebody just saying dumb things over and over and over, but he thinks he's so smart.
But I mean, the thing is, it's very lucrative, right? I mean, Ben, the people going down this road, it's like the Q-tubers. It's actually really popular. He's saying things that people wish they could say out loud, and he's getting paid a lot of money for it. Let me play a little bit more of his statement. This is what he said on Sunday. Take a listen to this.
I'm not trying to promote misinformation. I'm not trying to be controversial. These podcasts are very strange because they're just conversations. And oftentimes I have no idea what I'm going to talk about until I sit down and talk to people. And that's why some of my ideas are not that prepared or fleshed out, because I'm literally having them in real time.
He's like, I'm just accidentally saying things. I'm opening my mouth and like words are falling out accidentally. Yes, he is trying to say everything that he's saying. I mean, I'm going to throw it to you, Ben, because misinformation is deliberate. It's not like, well, I accidentally opened my mouth and whoops, I said, don't get vaccinated.
I will say, Joy, you know, it isn't 3 hours of the galaxy brain stuff. It's not 3 straight hours of insane stuff, but that's how he reels you in, right? That's how all of these things work, is that he'll talk to you in a regular cadence about normal stuff for about 10 minutes, and then the 11th minute, it kind of goes off the rails, right? I do think you got to go back to the start, like the Joe Rogan origin story here, right? He was on YouTube. He was a YouTuber. And for some reason, for several years, 3 or 4 years, most videos that came from the alt-right, the recommendations algorithm dragged them towards Joe Rogan videos. And it's still unclear if he had anything to do with this. I actually don't think he did. But then he started serving that audience. And that audience is a lot more interested in what Alex Jones has to say than what a doctor has to say. And once you start serving that audience exclusively, then you sort of cut yourself off from traditional thought processes about how, say, a pandemic works necessarily. Spotify, I'm sure, gave him a call this weekend and was like, look, you gotta get back to reality here on some of this stuff, because it's hurting people and it's hurting our bottom line. And maybe he can shift himself back towards, having real conversations about public health here that come closer to real world conversations and not the YouTube algorithm conversations that he's driven himself towards.
I doubt it, because it would be less lucrative and you'd probably get less listeners. And Teray, I mean, you do a podcast. You do a very popular podcast, actually. I mean, you're in this world. I mean, the difference here is that Spotify is not like YouTube or like Twitter. They are his publisher. Like, they actually put, you know, they're in a different relationship with him than YouTube is. YouTube just has lots of people on the platform. They're literally his publisher. Just talk a little bit about that world and how it works.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Spotify starts, of course, disseminating musicians, right? But the music industry has basically a stranglehold over their earnings, where they get a very tiny amount of the money that is earned from streaming, and the contracts with the music industry are renewed constantly, so they can never actually make that much of a profit off of music. And then one day they discovered something's going on over here, podcasts. That is making us a lot of money, and we could really profit off of podcasts. And they went really deep into the podcasting world, purchasing podcasting companies and buying all the wanting to become the home for pod. So whenever you think of podcasting, you want Jemele Hill, you go over there. You want, you know, Ibram Kendi, you go over there. And of course, you want Joe Rogan, you go over there. So the Joni Mitchells and the Neil Youngs can only have so much of an impact because they are a teeny part of what Spotify is actually earning money from. Joe Rogan is actually bringing a lot of people in the door. So, you know, unless you say somebody like a Taylor Swift is going to say, I'm deplatforming my music from Spotify, they're probably not really going to listen to those of us. I mean, you know, Joe Rogan definitely does not prepare for his shows. That is clear, right? Like I can tell when I listen to you that you are prepared for the interview. He is clearly not prepared. I can tell he just goes on there and just spits whatever comes to mind. He's a comedian. He's used to just going up on the mic and just talking, and that's what he does.
And that's why people like it. And that is why he is so actually dangerous and really powerful, and it is quite dangerous. Ben Collins, Teray, thank y'all very much. Appreciate you both. All right, don't go anywhere. Tonight's Absolute Worst is up next, because who knew? Political theater tickets could be so dang expensive. Stay with us. It hasn't been a good week for GOP governors cosplaying as autocratic leaders. There's Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin, who created a Kremlin-style tip line for parents to report anything divisive taught in schools, basically meaning books by Black, Jewish, and LGBTQ people. But his spokesman cannot even explain how the tip line works, declining twice to answer questions such as who monitors the account, what steps are taken after reports are received, and whether the administration plans to contact those mentioned in those complaints. And then there's Texas Governor Greg Abbott, who has spectacularly bungled his Trumpy fever dream of a performance art piece at the Mexican border. His Operation Lone Star, because of course that's what it's called, launched in March and sent local police and National Guardsmen to the southern border to arrest migrants on state trespassing charges. It's faced numerous legal issues, with a judge recently ruling that it's unconstitutional since it treads on federal immigration policy. Not to mention the ethical issues for the migrants arrested, with 50 state Democrats asking the DOJ and Homeland Security to look into the operation, noting that it is a mockery of the due process rights foundational to our nation's judicial process. But to add on to all of that, the guardsmen Abbott sent to the border have been treated terribly. Not only are they bored because they do not actually have the aforementioned federal authority to enforce immigration laws, but their paychecks were delayed, and some have been at the border longer than they were deployed overseas. As Abbott has spent more on the border, the guardsmen faced budget cuts, with their tuition assistance cut in half last year. And tragically, there's even been a wave of suicides among guardsmen, with four dying in the past few months. It is bad enough that Operation Lone Star has led to inhumane treatment for immigrants, and that the state has spent a whopping $3 billion on immigration enforcement in 2021, money that could have gone to actually helping Texans. But even worse is the cavalier way that the state of Texas has treated the people they forced to implement their failed mission. So much for supporting the troops. And that is why Texas Governor Greg Abbott and Operation Lone Star are tonight's absolute worst. And that is tonight's All In. And that's tonight's readout.